Ultramar. It's worse than Armageddon, come to that.
You speak as if Chagoras is free of such things,
Galdas said, as Sabodan snagged a decanter from a passing servant. The startled man yelped and fled. Sabodan poured himself another goblet of wine and sniffed it.
Not free, no. And hardly any more subtle. Though it pains me to admit it. It is the nature of man to scramble for any advantage when the seasons change.
He took a sip and licked his lips.
Good vintage, he murmured.
Then,
I do not blame them, brother, or Aemon for encouraging them. Which he is, in his way. It is simply tedious. When your tent burns, do you waste time arguing about how the fire started, or do you put it out? Sound advice. Perhaps we should switch places. Oh, no. This is your burden, brother. Bear it in good humor and leave the rest to us.
Sabodan drained his goblet and refilled it.
I'm surprised to see you out of your armor, he said. Did you have that uniform specially made for the occasion?
In a sense,
Calder said. All Huskarls were provided with the same uniform, tailored to their massive frame. The outfit was black and simple, after the fashion of post-unification Terra, with yellow piping and the chapter sigil pinned to their chest.
There are occasions when battle play is more hindrance than help. True. Few of our brothers, whatever their chapter, would admit such. I am not my brothers. Neither, I think, are you.
Sabodan snorted.
You do not know many of us, then.
He smiled.
We laugh as we kill. We find joy in the hunt. In war.
He gestured to his mantle.
This is as much my armor as my battle plate, and this chamber merely another field of war. I am happy here. You sons of Dawn find little joy in anything save your wars. At least, so goes the conventional wisdom.
Calder frowned, but refused to be baited.
Where is Karos? Sampling the local cuisine,
Sabodan said, nodding to one of the tables that lined the chamber. Karos hovered near it, peering at the food on display with seeming confusion. He was surrounded by a crowd of chattering nobles, talking around him.
He looks puzzled. An act. Our brother plays up his inhumanity, so that those watching him underestimate him. They think him blind to their jibes and ploys. He is taking their measure, even as we do, in our own ways.
Calder nodded. In that moment, he realized perhaps why Sabodan and Karos had been selected to accompany him. Both, like him, had dealt with mortals extensively. Sabodan, during the war for Armageddon, and Karos during the Jutton uprisings. Watching them at work, he saw new ways of approaching old problems. Then, that was the Lord Commander's method of operation. Learn by observation. A strong tenet, if a touch more passive than Calder was comfortable with. The Imperial Fists preferred to learn by doing. Wisdom was earned through pain. He found his gaze drawn to the far corner of the chamber, where Aemon sat, surrounded by scribes and advisers. The Cardinal Governor was dressed modestly, and speaking to one of his deacons. Sabodan followed his look.
What do you make of him?
Dedicated. If he is corrupt, he hides it well.
He hides it not at all.
Sabodan looked around meaningfully.
Then, perhaps that is to his credit. He seems willing to listen, which is more than most of them.
He set his goblet aside and upended the decanter, drinking straight from it.
Petty little men and their petty little kingdoms. Sometimes I wonder why we waste time playing the dutiful servants.
Would you rule them then?
No, but it might make things easier.
Sabodan glanced up at Calder.
I have heard that Gilliman thinks along the same lines. He intends to set his sons above certain potentates on certain worlds within the Ultramar system, or so I'd heard.
How did you come to hear that?
Sabodan tugged on his moustache, grinning.
You think we do not have our eyes and ears in the Crusade? I expect you do as well.
Calder looked away. In point of fact, the chapter did, something he had been unsettled to learn upon rejoining his brothers. All chapters, especially those with ties to Terra, had their own networks of spies these days. Some were more effective than others. In recent months, Calder had trained his own personal network of scribes, teaching them what to look for and what to disregard in the millions of reports he collected from across a variety of systems.
I know no more about what the Lord Commander intends than you do.
Sir Bowden nodded.
That is not a denial.
Calder glanced at him.
What do your brothers make of it?
Sir Bowden shrugged and took another swig from the decanter.
The Khans have not held a council to discuss it. Indeed, what is there to discuss? Ultramar is his, and the Jean sons of Gilliman obey the edicts of their father, as we would, should the Great Khan return from the Hunt of Ages, as would your brothers, should Dawn return. Gilliman is not Dawn,
Calder said.
Nor is he the Great Khan,
Sir Bowden peered at him.
The galaxy rests on a blade's edge, brother, balanced between victory and defeat. Which side does it tip towards? I suspect we will not know until the final moment.
Sir Bowden reached up and set a comradely fist on his shoulder. He smiled wildly.
That is the fun of it.
Calder smiled, if only for a moment. It faded a heartbeat later, as Sir Bowden said,
He's hiding something, of course.
Momentarily puzzled, Calder said,
Who? The Lord Commander?
Sir Bowden snorted.
Almost certainly, but no. Our host, he's hiding something. I can smell it on him. He's happy to see us, but it doesn't reach his eyes. He's worried. His world is under threat of invasion. That's not it.
Sir Bowden snatched a goblet from a passing tray and handed it to him.
Drink! It puts them at ease.
He tugged on his moustache again.
They've all got their secrets, these little men. Can't be a king without a few secrets. Secrets are not my concern. Only the defense of this world. Admirable. The little king calls for you, brother. Best see what he wants.
Calder turned and saw Eamon looking in their direction. He nodded to Sir Bowden and made his way to the Cardinal Governor's side. Eamon dismissed his associates with an impatient gesture, and they scattered. One or two of them shot baleful looks at Calder as they went. He pretended not to notice. He'd have to kill them otherwise.
Cardinal Governor,
he said by way of greeting. Eamon gestured. What do you think of it, then?
What?
The wine, Lieutenant. Calder looked down. He'd forgotten he was holding it. The goblet was perplexingly small in his grip. It was not gold, but was decorated to appear so, and deceptively soft. The slightest twitch would serve to crush it. He took a sip of the wine, and found it palatable at best. Not to your liking? Eamon asked. The Cardinal Governor was smiling slightly, as if amused by the sight. There are other vintages available.
They would be wasted on me. My body isolates and neutralizes toxins, rendering an issue solely of taste and smell, and I find the taste of fermented grapes somewhat lacking.
He gave the goblet an experimental twitch, but the odor did not alter. And yet you continue to drink?
One must be polite in mixed company.
Politis, Eamon said.
You sound surprised.
I did not expect it. Your kind are not known for your decorum.
He raised a hand before Calder could speak.
My apologies. That was uncivil. Yes, I was surprised.
He looked down into his own goblet for a moment. Then, what's he like?
Who?
The Lord Commander Gilliman. He hesitated.
It is him, isn't it? It's not just propaganda from Terra.
If it were, do you think I would answer honestly?
Eamon frowned and looked away.
I suppose not.
Calder was silent for a moment.
I do not know him, he said. I have met him only once, and then only briefly. But
I knelt before him without thinking, such was the power of him. Though he is not my gene sire, he is of the same materials. They exuded the same strength, the same sublime grace.
His voice grew soft.
Had he ordered me to, I'd have set myself against all the foes of mankind, barehanded and alone.
Aemon took a sip of his wine. Calder noticed that his hand was trembling.
Why did he send you here? Aemon asked.
He was for aid.
No, why you, specifically?
Calder considered the question for a moment. Then,
I am a Huskarl, one of the first for this new era.
He flexed his free hand.
Once, that term was reserved for those chosen to guard our Primarch, both on the battlefield and off. Now, it means something quite different. It is why I was chosen to lead this mission.
You guard worlds rather than lords, Aemon said.
Calder nodded, pleased by the Cardinal Governor's understanding.
We are good at guarding things, and Gilliman is wise enough to allow us to do what we are best at, rather than forcing us into an unsuitable role.
Are there many of you?
Not enough. Never enough. But there will be more before the end of this crusade. We shall build a wall of worlds to hold back the long night, and on each, a single watchman to ward it, come what may. We are Huskarls, and that is our oath.
Aemon was silent for long moments.
Will you be enough, though?
Calder considered this.
You expected more of us, he said.
Perhaps Gilliman himself come down in fire and glory to rescue you from the fiends in the night.
Aemon shook his head.
I expected nothing, Lieutenant. Not you, certainly not the risen sun. We are not important as worlds or systems go, and the reach of the ecclesiarchy is not as long as we like to imagine. That Gilliman considered us at all is a blessing from the God Emperor, though some do not see it so charitably.
Calder frowned and set his goblet down, gently.
Rebellion?
He asked quietly. He looked around the chamber at the wide array of faces and titles on display.
I wouldn't dignify it with that term, no.
Aemon dabbed his lips with his napkin and sat back.
Discontent is a more accurate word, I think. I have been soft-hearted.
He smiled bitterly.
I have shown tolerance for the dissenting and sympathy for the unhappy. I have allowed certain members of the Ecumenical Council to abuse my favour in return to keep the peace on Almace and in the wider system. I have even spared the lives of those aristocratic families that sought to destabilize my position.
Calder considered this.
Unwise, he said.
Aemon nodded.
Very much so, I expect. The Kabalevskis gave this world to the Ecclesiarchy. Some of their descendants decided that they wanted it back some time ago. Tried every trick in the book to unseat me. I finally had to exile the lot of them. It taught the rest to be quieter about their ambitions, but
they still seek to undermine you.
Not intentionally, I think, but yes.
Aemon's smile slipped. Most of them aren't even aware that we've been invaded. They would panic, or worse, incite panic in others.
That is the reason for this feast, then?
A bit of ceremony, before things become awkward.
Aemon leaned forward. Some of them will not believe it, even after we tell them. They will assume it is a game on my part, or some attempt to shore up what they consider my faltering regime.
Already there are whispers that the Holy Synod is to be petitioned for my removal, and a new dynasty installed. Some believe that the Kabalevskis will return in the world's darkest hour, like the kings of old night.
He chuckled and shook his head.
I did what was needed. And now I find I can do nothing at all, except wait.
There is much you can do, Cardinal Governor. Yours is the voice which commands. I will need you to use it in the near future. Necessity is a bitter pill for the powerful and the weak alike.
Calder looked down at him.
You are not what I expected, Cardinal Governor. That is to your credit. Do not lose hope now, not when salvation is but a handbreadth away.
Eamon nodded. Huskarl, indeed, he said. He turned, and Calder saw a soldier, a junior officer by his insignia, hurrying through the crowd. The man bent respectfully over Eamon's chair and murmured quietly into his ear. Calder was able to hear his words easily enough, however, and when Eamon rose, he wasn't surprised.
The enemy has been sighted, Eamon pitched his voice low.
As Calder followed the Cardinal Governor from the chamber, he signalled Sabodin and Karos. The time for feasting was over. Scribes and messengers were hurrying through the halls of the cathedral palace as they made their way to the strategium. Scrivener servitors etched lines of ink across reams of parchment as officers spoke to one another in cramped alcoves. There was a sense of anticipation on the air, and not a little fear.
"I am told you brought a fleet," Eamon said as they approached the doors. "I fear we may need it, weak as our own system defence force is at the moment."
"Two strike cruisers and a battle barge, as well as escorts," Calder said.
"A small fleet," Eamon said doubtfully.
"The Silent Horseman alone could defend this system,"
Sabodin said, his tone betraying his annoyance.
"That battle barge weathered the firestorms above Armageddon and burst the heart of an orc rock with its prow.
The Capulus and Raven's valour, while not so large, are equally blooded,"
Calder added.
"Two strike cruisers and a battle barge are a fleet unto themselves, not counting the dozen frigates that escort them." "A better fleet than what you have now, at least,"
Sabodin said.
"Were the situation different, I might strike your head from your shoulders for such an insult."
Eamon nodded hurriedly, his eyes wide with alarm.
I meant no insult, my lords.
Sabodin grunted and looked at Calder. There was a glimmer of cold amusement in the White Scar's eyes, and Calder suddenly realized that Sabodin was only pretending to be angry, though he could not fathom why. Perhaps simply for the fun of it.
"We take no insult," Calder said, and Eamon gave him a grateful look.
He stopped.
"If you could go ahead, Cardinal Governor, I wish to discuss a private matter with the Khan."
He nodded to Karos.
"Karos will accompany you."
"I shall leave you to it, then." Eamon paused. "Lieutenant, I do not know whether or not you eat as a man might, but if you would do me the honour, I would like to extend an invitation to break your fast with me tomorrow. I feel there will be much to discuss, and I find I often work best over a meal."
Calder nodded.
"I will attend."
Eamon nodded.
"Good. I will meet you in the strategium."
He left them, his bodyguards falling in around him, and Karos following after. Sabodin watched them go and chuckled. Calder frowned.
"Why the pretense?"
"You noticed,"
Sabodin sounded pleased.
"A man like Eamon needs reminding about our nature every so often."
He tapped his amulets.
"They confuse their authority for true power. They cannot be allowed to chastise us, however mildly, and escape censure. Else they will grow bold."
He frowned.
"Our brothers, the wolves, made that mistake once. We learn from their errors."
He bared his teeth in a grin.
"To, it puts you in his good graces. Where he fears me, or Karos, he will cling to you."
"He should not fear me, then?"
"Not in the same way he fears us. We are wolves, prowling in the dark. You are a mastiff, guarding the herd, you see."
Calder shook his head.
"I should not have agreed to dine with him."
Sabodin stroked his moustache.
"Never turn down food when your host offers it. It is rude. Besides, it will aid the illusion that you are on his side. Am I not? You served the Lord Commander, brother. Last I checked, he wasn't here."
Sabodin clapped him on the shoulder.
"Come, let us see what games the enemy is playing."
Swordmaster Tyre was waiting for them in the strategium, along with Canonus Law. He was scowling as data scrawled across the floating projection. He glanced at them as they arrived, and the crowd of officers and scribes surrounding him evaporated at a terse gesture.
A long-range debris trawler spotted them, my lords. It's unmanned, save for an engine seer to keep the servitors functional. Luckily, he's more observant than most of them.
The hololithic image flickered, and a pict feed appeared. It showed a debris field, a graveyard of broken vessels and cosmic junk. Every system had them, places where forgotten things congregated and were picked over by salvagers for anything of value. Tyre pointed at a crimson dot on the feed, a brief flare as of engines firing.
Telemetry indicates that they came out of the debris field here. If they're staying close to the rest of the fleet, that means that it should be, here.
A set of coordinates was illuminated.
From that, we've extrapolated the position and formation.
More runes flashed into sight.
What about the trawler? Calder said.
Tyre gestured dismissively.
They destroyed it a few moments after the feed was transmitted.
He frowned.
That's them, though. I'm sure of it. What world is that?
Calder asked.
Pergamon,
Tyre said.
It's one of the larger worlds, a tithe hub. There are orbital dockyards and numerous transit points. Captain Keel is already planning to take the system defense fleet out and meet them there. It'll take him a day, maybe two, to reach them. If we can hold them there, it might buy us a few days more.
Pergamon has substantial orbital defenses, Calder said, studying the data.
As I said, it's a tithe hub. There's frequent pirate activity around that area. Two, there's the library.
The library, Aemon echoed. He closed his eyes. Holy throne, bless and keep us.
What library is this?
Sir Bowden demanded.
The Apostolic Libraria, a repository of liturgical texts numbering in the millions,
Calder answered, before Aemon could.
One of the largest of its type in this sector.
Sir Bowden snorted.
Hardly a strategic objective.
It is the most important thing on that planet, Canonus Law said, speaking up for the first time. A commandery of my order guards it, and the Sister Dialogus who see to the maintenance of its contents. The texts there are part of the foundation of ecclesiarchal canon, the seeds from which the imperial cult germinated.
They're breaking the pattern,
Kara said. He gestured to the pict captures.
With the other worlds, they employed an Epsilon Montero formation, static wedge, with an emphasis on alternating orbital strikes. They landed few troops, and only after most of the world was on fire. But here... A test run,
Calder said. The others looked at him.
This world is the second largest in the system, and the most well-defended next to Almace.
He paused.
They're practicing.
Practicing?
Law snarled.
Practicing?
Tyre placed a hand on her shoulder and leaned over to murmur something. She shrugged him off and turned her glare on Aemon.
We must preserve the library, no matter how many lives it costs.
And how do you have me do that, Canonus, when we are here and it is there?
Aemon said.
Captain Keel is taking the fleet. It is in the God Emperor's hands now.
Law bared her teeth.
We have a fleet of oar-haulers, of pleasure yachts, and trading vessels in orbit right now. Commandeer them all. My sisters will board them, and we will meet the foe with fire and steel. Even if I could do that, it would take too much time.
He met her glare without faltering. I need you and your sisters here to protect this world and all that it contains.
Calder expected Law to protest further. Instead, she stiffened and turned away.
Pergamon is lost, Aemon said. But its loss can buy us victory. We must begin the work of the final hour and make of Almace a rock which might withstand the tides of abomination.
His voice rang out, and scribes, officers and servants stopped to listen. Calder saw that this too was a test. Aemon was readying himself for the grand speeches to come. The Cardinal Governor looked at Tyre.
It is time, I think, to make my flock aware of what faces us.
He looked at Calder.
Past time, perhaps.
Tyre frowned.
There'll be unrest. Every world in the core will be screaming over the Vox for troops and ships that we can't give them. Let them scream. They might distract the foe.
Sabodan peered at the star map and stroked his beard. He looked at Calder.
How much time do you estimate we have before they arrive, brother? A few days? A week? Or only hours?
If they're stopping at every world between Pergamon and here, a week, perhaps less, depending on how much of a fight the remains of the System Defense Fleet can put up.
Sabodan nodded thoughtfully.
Time is a valuable commodity in any campaign. The more time you have, the higher your walls grow. How much time do you need to make Almace impregnable, brother?
More time than we have.
Sabodan laughed.
No false pride there, then. Fine. How much time to make the defenses adequate for purpose?
Calder answered immediately.
2 weeks, possibly three.
That I can buy you.
Sabodan traced a line across the hololith, causing the image to flicker.
There are a number of points between here and the enemy where we might meet them to our advantage. Give me command of the System Defense Fleet, and I'll take the Silent Horseman, Ravensvala, and half of the escorts we brought. With that, we might be able to bloody them sufficiently for our purposes.
What about Pergamon? Eamon asked.
Sabodan's plan would leave him only the Capulus and a handful of escorts to defend Almace. Workable, but unpleasant. Sabodan fixed him with a steady gaze.
You said it yourself. It is lost. But its loss will buy us the time we need to get into position. The enemy will be drugged by victory. Overconfident. Easy meat, if we are clever.
You will not be able to beat them,
Calder said.
Preliminary reports put their fleets at numbers far in excess of our own. Yes, but you are assuming their fleet will maintain integrity as it travels coreward.
Sabodan's smile was hard and cruel.
If they were us, they might. But they are not. And it will not. I have hunted this prey before, brother. They will not be able to resist the outlying worlds any more than orcs could. It is their nature to prey on the defenseless and the weak. And we will use that to our advantage.
Calder paused.
How? Refugees?
Karos interjected. Sabodan nodded.
Some always escape. Sometimes they allow them to do so, if only to prolong the hunt. So, as they hunt the refugees, we will hunt them.
He clapped his hands together.
We will drag our prey into the dark like the great cats of the plains, and the enemy will have little idea what has occurred.
Calder nodded. The White Scar's plan was simple and effective, if callous.
And if they investigate?
Then we flee! We draw them off, further and further from armies. Some will press on, but we will peel away their numerical superiority, if all goes well.
Sabodan turned from the projection.
We of Chagoris are as the wind, always moving, always racing. We chill the blood and steal the breath of our foes. It runs through us and carries us to victory.
He made a fist.
Let me be the wind, Calder. I will run our foes to their deaths.
Calder gazed at the White Scar. Releasing Sabodan's brotherhood to hunt would leave him down almost a third of his force. But by the same token, forcing them behind walls had its own disadvantages. Joint operations between chapters had ever been fraught affairs. Even the most congenial of chapters had its own preferred method of war. To ignore it was to risk angering allies. Two, his command, though ordered by Gilliman himself, was a tenuous thing. He was outranked by both Sabodan and Karos. Though they had bent the knee to him thus far, they would only obey so long as their experience was not dismissed out of hand. All of this flashed through Calder's mind in moments, followed by rapid calculations.
Air power, he said. I would need pilots capable of keeping the skies clear for evacuation and extraction.
Sabodan grinned.
Of course. I can leave you as many wind riders as you like, so long as the rest of us are free to hunt the stars.
Calder nodded.
Your plan seems solid enough.
Sabodan glanced at Karos.
Solid, he says. High praise from a son of Dawn.
But I cannot give you command of the system defense fleet, Calder added. He pointed to Aemon.
Only he can.
Sabodan wheeled about and fixed the Cardinal Governor with a patient stare.
Well, he rumbled, shall I take your scraps of steel and forge a blade from them?
Aemon looked away from the projection, his face tight and pale. Do I have a choice? Sabodan's smile was not friendly.
You always have a choice, Cardinal Governor. As the Quasim were known to say, the Tree of Woe has many branches.
But it has only one trunk, Aemon recited absently. Sabodan nodded.
Even so.
I will need to convene the Ecumenical Council. The things you want, I must put them before the councillors.
And if they say no?
Aemon frowned. They will not. There was an undercurrent of savage anticipation in Aemon's voice, and Calder thought of what the Cardinal Governor had said earlier. Whatever his past weaknesses, Aemon seemed determined to erase them. Calder nodded.
Good. Then we can begin.
Chapter 5, 180000. Pergamon, Secundus Grade Tithe World. Alarm klaxons pierced the air, echoing through the rock-crete halls. A tide of humanity filled the corridors of the Administratum building, shouting, shoving, weeping and whispering. Most were menial drones or ministerium scribes, about the business of their diverse masters. Palatine Sharla Cern ignored them, and they parted before her like minnows in front of a shark. They knew her, at least by reputation, and feared her. The commandery Cern led was small, less than 100 battle sisters, their remit extending only to the grounds of the Apostolic Libraria, at least in times of peace. During war, she was second in command of the planet's military. It was in that capacity that she and her bodyguards had made their way across the city from the library. The journey had not been without incident. The city was breaking down. Panic ruled the streets, despite the best efforts of the enforcers. The evacuation efforts were taking too long, and the city's defense bunkers were already full. But Cern had no time for such concerns. There were other matters that required her attention. The enemy were on their doorstep, and she intended to greet them with fire and steel. Cern was a tall woman, and willowy beneath her grey battle plate. She was young for her rank, but had earned it the hard way, as her augmetic arm attested. It was a fine thing, artfully wrought and without the glitches common to such prosthetics. Holy verses had been etched into its panels, and a miniature Promethean cylinder was hidden in the forearm. A flick of the wrist and a spurt of cleansing flame would wreathe her artificial hand. Besides the hand, she had a bolt pistol holstered at her side and a power maul in her fist. Two battle sisters of her commandery followed in her wake, bolt guns held at the ready. They swept the corridor with hard, flat gazes, and no one dared hinder them.
"Witless crooks," one murmured as she stepped past a trembling scribe.
Cern glanced back.
"They're frightened, Cassilla. A day they thought impossible has come."
Cassilla flushed slightly at Cern's chiding tone.
"Forgive me, Palatine. I spoke out of turn." "There is nothing to forgive, sister. Merely keep such observations to yourself in the future. You never know who might be listening."
Cern gestured upwards, where a cyber cherub crouched atop a lintel, watching them with augmetic eyes. The creatures were everywhere, on every planet of the system. Or so Cern had heard. They kept watch for the Cardinal Governor, or perhaps even the Holy Synod. Or maybe they watched only because that was what they were programmed to do. Still, one could never be too careful. More than one sister had paid for the sins of a loose tongue and a free opinion. More alarms sounded. These were different in pitch. As they passed by one of the great stained-glass windows that lined the far wall, Cern saw slow streaks of fire painting the night sky.
"Debris alarms," Cassilla said, looking up.
"They must have reached the orbital defense array."
quicker than we expected, the other battle sister Gurna said.
They always are, Cern said.
Calculations are rarely as accurate as we might like. Remember that for the future. She stopped and turned.
There may come a time when you are in my place, with the fate of your sisters on your shoulders. Calculations, estimates, auguries, and telemetry, all of these are fallible. Only faith can be trusted. Allow it to guide you, and it will always lead you to victory.
Or to Pergamon, Cassilla said with a slight smile. No one said victory was instantaneous, Cern said sternly. Now be silent, both of you. We have an example to set.
But as she continued down the corridor, she couldn't help but glance at the windows. The ancient glass quivered slightly in its frames. It would shatter at the first impact of the debris falling from orbit. The city itself would buckle. It might survive, but not in one piece. Streaks of slow flame stretched across the dark skies, and she wondered at their number. More than she'd expected. Too many. The attack on Pergamon had not come as a surprise to Cern. She had expected it for some time, given the warnings from Almes and Canonus Law. In the days since that first, brief astropathic message, she had worked diligently to ready her mission, and Pergamon, for war. She had commandeered vessels, organized evacuation procedures, and prepared the planetary defense levies for what was to come. But it was not enough. It was never enough. A hard lesson learned early in her days at the Schola Progenium. Time was the one commodity that could not be hoarded. It could only be spent, either foolishly or wisely. She hoped she had done the latter.
"The sky is on fire, Duran," she called out as she stalked into the Strategium. The chamber was circular. A glass dome surmounted the roof, its facets etched with an expensive, if inaccurate, star map of the system. Data alcoves lined the walls. Within each, a servitor, hardwired into the orbital defense array, rattled off reports in grating monotone. Officers of the planetary defense levy scrambled to calculate potential landing zones and organize Pergamon's defenders to repel the enemy.
"I had noticed, thank you."
Pernik Duran was overall commander of the levies for Pergamon, but Cern and her sisters were outside the chain of command. They'd achieved an easy equilibrium after a memorable, if grueling, bout in the training cages during her first year on Pergamon. Cern smiled thinly.
"You're welcome."
She waved Gurna and Cassilla back, and they took up positions to either side of the door.
"How bad is it?"
"Very."
Duran was a tall man and stocky, a scion of one of the oldest Crusader houses of Terra. He showed no sign of worry, despite his assertion. He wore heavy carapace armor over a set of crimson robes and a power sword sheathed at his side.
"The defense platforms are antiques, and the enemy are not particularly bothered by losses."
Cern bared her teeth. "Neither are we." Duran smiled.
"Unfortunately, they outnumber us."
He gestured to the hololithic defense projection, flickering at the center of the chamber. A pitiful handful of tacticum analysis surrounded it, making notations and updating the projection as the servitors reported changes. Most of them were older. The upper echelons of Pergamon's military were retired, or on some form of extended punishment detail. Cern shook her head.
"Not all of them are planning to land. They never do."
"Not all, but enough. It will come down to blades."
He looked at her.
"Are your sisters ready for what is to come?"
"If we were not, I would not be here."
She slapped the bolt pistol holstered on her hip. "We will fight them for as long as we are able." A servitor squalled suddenly and shuddered. The withered creature thrashed in its alcove and slumped, smoke boiling from its contact nodes. Another orbital defense platform had been destroyed. The feedback was hard on the servitors. More than one hung limp from their nest of cabling and nutrient feeds.
"We've lost a third of the orbital defenses,"
Duran said, as attendants hurriedly tried to douse the twitching servitor with retardant foam before it started a fire. A moment later, as another servitor convulsed and fell, Duran added,
"Two-thirds."
He drew his blade in a whetstone.
Slowly, he began to scrape the stone along the blade.
"They'll pass through the gauntlet soon, sister, and then will come a true testing of our faith."
"You look forward to it,
don't you?"
Cern ran a hand over her close-cropped hair. "No, I am certain in my faith, but I am not certain in my ability to defend the Apostolic Libraria from the forces arrayed against us."
Duran nodded.
"We will die."
"Those are not comforting words, brother."
"We will die well."
Cern snorted. "Better, if not by much." More alarm klaxons sounded. Impacts were being registered as the first comets of debris reached the planet's surface. The murmur of voices grew heated. Heads turned as the doors to the Strategium were flung open with a dull boom. "Oh, look, the Lord Deacon has arrived." She gestured surreptitiously, and her bodyguards relaxed. It wouldn't do to gun down the planet's de facto ruler. Not yet, at any rate.
"At last, his wisdom has been sorely missed."
Duran's voice was utterly deadpan. Deacon Holmer was a gaunt, sallow-faced man, draped in crimson and white. He wore no crown of office, but his grey hair was pulled back from his sharp features in a tight braid. A servitor clomped in his wake, filling the air with sweet-smelling smoke from the dozens of censers attached to its withered husk. Cyber-cherubs fluttered about him, squealing to one another in binaric, their optic sensors recording everything for posterity. He was trailed by a coterie of bodyguards and hangers-on. Cern recognized some of them, minor nobility, agri-bosses and traders. Most of their kind had fled the moment word of the enemy's approach had reached them. They joined the grand exodus of trawlers, barges, corvettes and yachts, making for the safety of Almes. Some had even volunteered to carry refugees, once Cern had promised not to execute them and commandeer their vessels for the holy cause. Those that remained were either fools or ambitious, or both. She studied them, noting which ones seemed nervous and which seemed eager. Either might prove troublesome.
"Greetings, my Lord Deacon,"
Duran began. The Crusader stepped forward and bowed.
"As you can see, we have begun..." "What is the meaning of this?"
Holmes snarled, interrupting him.
"Why was I not informed that the attack had begun?"
"We thought it fairly self-evident," Cern said.
Holmes had been her burden for almost a decade, a minor functionary given more authority than he could handle. He spent most of his time living well off whatever he could skim from the planetary tithe. He had surrounded himself with a nest of cronies and lickspittles, and paid little attention to anything that did not directly benefit him. The perfect planetary overseer, in other words. Holmer rounded on her.
"What?"
"The sky is on fire and has been for hours. You would have noticed had you stepped outside your pleasure palaces."
Cern met his glare with a beatific smile. Holmer had no concept of what was occurring. For him, war meant pirates or the workers of some isolated agri-facility getting revolutionary ideas. He was scared. She could see it in his eyes. Holmer frowned.
"Canonist Law will hear of your disrespect!"
"If we survive the next few hours, I'm sure she will."
Cern made to turn away, but Holmer caught her arm.
"I am the ruler of this world. You do not turn away from me."
Cern looked at his hand and then at him. He released her and backed away hastily.
"Don't threaten me," he snapped.
"Did you hear me threaten him?" she asked Duran.
"It was a very intimidating glare." "I should have you both shot for insubordination,"
Holmes said, face flushed with embarrassment. He didn't understand that he was nothing more than a distraction now, that his authority had been superseded the moment the enemy had been sighted. She traded glances with Duran, and he frowned.
"Oh, very well," she murmured.
"Thank you,"
Duran said. He looked at Holmer.
"As of this moment, your authority over this world has been supplanted by my own, as per ecclesiarchal dictate Signum Crucis. You will acknowledge this."
Duran waited. Holmer frowned, likely trying to recall what the particular dictate entailed.
He glanced at his clique, as if considering his next move. None of them were soldiers. Duran held the reins too tightly for that. But a fair few thought themselves warriors. Though the Adeptus Ministerium frowned on dueling, it happened, especially among those families tied to the ecclesiarchy by blood. They were touchy, these holy bloods. Their ties to the system's rulers made them arrogant as well. Thankfully, most of them had eyes only for the hololithic projections that danced across the air before them. The air chimed, and a scattering of pic displays sent from an external auger array flickered into view. Cern saw the city, a spread of hab blocks and towering structures that spread down one slope of an immense crater. She'd been born in a hive. Pergamon, with its sloped contours and spillage of streets, had taken some getting used to. The city spread like grey mould, clinging to the curve of the crater, and stretching downwards to the vast lake that had formed at the bottom. The water from that lake fed the city, and several others besides. Beyond the city, the night sky had turned a dull, angry orange. Slashes of heat marred the horizon, and servitors intoned impact coordinates. One stiffened in its alcove and blurted a warning.
Impact at grid coordinates alpha, zeta, epsilon, imminent, imminent, imminent. Impact in 20, 19, 18.
Instinctively, Cern looked up.
I don't see it, she began.
But she heard the great glass dome flex and whine in its frame. Cracks appeared, running across it like spiderwebs. A moment later, the building shook as a dull boom echoed through the chamber.
Impact registered,
the servitor said, in the silence that followed.
Ground all air traffic, Duran said to an aide. Anything still in the sky in the next hour won't be there for long. Tell Klostermeyer to ready the anti-air batteries.
Holmes spluttered.
You can't do that! How are we supposed to leave the city?
He indicated his coterie with an outraged gesture.
There's always the grav train, Cern said.
Holmes grimaced. The grav train was clunky and archaic, a relic from more primitive times. The network stretched across the planet, but was currently running over capacity, thanks to the tide of panic sweeping the world. People were running, seeking sanctuary or a way off-world.
You won't be leaving the city, Lord Deacon,
Duran said, fixing Holmes with a stern eye.
Pergo is the capital, the center without which this world would not hold. You are the moral and spiritual authority, as ordained by Cardinal Governor Aemon. Your place is here, among your people.
Holmes stared at him.
What? You heard him, Lord Deacon.
Cern gestured, and her bodyguards closed the chamber doors and positioned themselves to intercept any attempt at flight.
The hour of your glory has come around. You will need to prepare speeches, sermons, a triumphal address.
Then victory is certain? All things are certain when one has faith, my lord,
Duran said. He gestured to two of his officers.
Escort the Lord Deacon and his attendants to the bunkers below. See that they are comfortable. I will join you directly.
Cern's bodyguards opened the doors at her nod, and she watched as the Lord Deacon was escorted out.
Very neat, she said.
Duran accepted the compliment with a nod.
Once he's safely in the bunker, he can panic to his heart's content.
He'll have to kill the silly bastard before this is through. You know that, don't you?
She looked at him.
Otherwise, he'll attempt to undermine you once he figures out how precarious his position has become.
Duran looked away.
I honestly don't think we have that long.
He looked up at the display.
They're not in position for a siege. They're ignoring the major landing zones and concentrating on the cities themselves. This is an assault. I don't think they care about taking this planet or this city in one piece. They're after something else.
Cern's hand fell to her power maul. A sudden premonition struck her. She looked at Duran, and he nodded.
Yes, I think they've come for the Apostolic Libraria.
he said.
Then they know, she said softly. Have you alerted Almace?
Our astropaths were struck dumb and blind a few hours ago, and the intersystem vox relay is experiencing interference.
Duran sighed and lifted his sword, studying his reflection in its polished length. He lowered it and looked at her.
The first of their ships have entered the gravity well, or soon will. All that remains is to do as we have sworn, and pray the Emperor guides our hands.
Cern hesitated, then clasped his shoulder.
Die well, Duran.
You too, sister. If the worst comes to pass,
I know what must be done.
Cern turned away.
I pray only that I have the strength to do it.
Status,
Imatnim murmured. Around him, the Glory Eternal rocked, as if in the throes of passion. And perhaps it was. For a vessel like this, war was as love. Alarms blared, and the voices of the crew, human and otherwise, rose in accompaniment.
We've entered the planet's gravity well. Shields holding.
One of the word-bearers stationed on the observation deck replied, his helm's vox grill turning his words into a growl. Then, with obvious glee, he added,
Akrix's sigh wasn't so lucky. She's gone.
That was, Abatnam struggled to recall the name of the frigate's captain, Eran Buko, a brother of the Third Hand, wasn't he?
Aye, my lord, and a more pestiferous jackal there never was.
Speak not ill of the glorious dead, brother, whatever cause they might give you.
Amatnam said with mild reproach. He peered at the warrior.
Kellim, isn't it? You were also of the Third Hand, I recall.
Kellim nodded.
Briefly, my lord.
The way he said it implied that he did not much miss those days. Things had changed in the years since the Warmaster had cracked open the Eye of Terror and cast forth the light of truth across the galaxy. The old ways, already fraying, had unraveled completely. Brothers had become hosts, and hosts had shattered into brotherhoods once more, as the infighting of the Dark Council grew ever fiercer. The old ways of waging war were no longer applicable in a galaxy that was coming undone. Klaxon sounded as the deck shuddered like a wounded beast. Slaves scurried in all directions, attempting to douse fires or carry orders to duty stations. Word-bearers bellowed litanies of war down below, on the command deck. On the view screen, the void was aflame. Ships burned in the black. Not so many as it seemed at first glance, but enough to make a Matnim repress a wince. Their target's orbital defences were stronger than he'd anticipated, or maybe the fleet was simply less disciplined than he'd hoped. Antiquated orbital defence platforms unleashed salvos of torpedoes into the teeth of their advance. Escorts intercepted most of these, however unwittingly. The other worlds all had some minor defences, platforms of laser batteries or single-launch plasma lances, more useful against space debris or lone pirate vessels than an enemy fleet. But this was different. Deadly. Beams of silent destruction glittered in the dark as his fleet returned fire. The slaves wired into the Vox alcoves, rasp reports from its captains, damage estimates, firing solutions, maneuvers, demands for action. Warriors like Kellim filtered the noise from the information, keeping him up to date. Through it all, Imatnim watched, standing at the edge of the observation deck, riding the rhythm of battle. The gods' voices were clearest here, in these moments, when it was all balanced on a knife edge. One lucky shot, one unforeseen fluctuation in the Glory Eternal's shields, and his glories would be nothing more than a forgotten promise. The gods were fickle, and ever hungry for twists and turns in the lives of those who entertain them.
Status,
he said again. He didn't turn. Vibrant hues stretched across the viewscreen as a defense platform was reduced to debris. It tumbled away, caught by Pergamon's gravity and drawn planetwards like a fiery comet.
The Hawk of Sicarius and Night's Angel are moving into launch position at grid points 8 and 37, respectfully,
Kellum said.
The Slaughter Queen is taking heavy fire from the second quadrant defense platforms. She can't break the line.
Divert Olympia's Bane and the Ucephalot. Have them run interference. We need the Slaughter Queen's landing bays more than we need them.
Should I tell them that?
There was an undercurrent of dark amusement in Kellum's voice. Amatnam considered it, but only for a moment.
No. They understand their place in this design. As do we all.
Amatnam crossed his arms. Void War had never greatly appealed to him. It lacked the immediacy of ground operations and required more forethought. On the viewscreen, his fleet encircled the planet, attacking from all directions, or so it seemed to the casual observer. In truth, it was a precise ballet of calculation and statistical analysis. Every ship was but one part of the great mechanism of the fleet. Only when all acted in accordance was success assured. He watched as a frigate tumbled in its death throes. Its plasma drive sputtered silently, venting the vessel's lifeblood into space. It was still intact, however, and he made a note to organize salvage teams. The orbital dockyards here were small, insignificant, compared to those of Sicarius, but use could be had of them if they survived. Prompted by the thought, he glanced at Kellum.
Status of the dockyards?
Unknown,
Kellum said.
We have landed troops in the docking bays, but given the confusion, it is hard to get an accurate report. I can try to make contact.
No, leave it for now. No need to distract them. If it is the will of the gods, they will be successful. If not, they won't.
Amatnam turned his attentions back to the battle. Ships forced their way through the storm of fire unleashed by the defense platforms and pierced the stratosphere. Landing troops was an imprecise business. There were too many variables. You had to breach your world's gravity well, put yourself at its mercy, and hope your vessel was strong enough to weather the inevitable ground-to-air flak. But it had to be done.
My lord, it is time.
Amatnam turned to see Apis stepping up onto the observation deck. The other word-bearer was every inch the soldier. His battered crimson battleplate was free of writing or sigils, save for the Legion's symbol on one shoulder plate. He had a modified drum-fed bolt gun slung under his arm from a heavy leather strap. Extra drums of ammunition hung from his heavy combat rig, alongside a sheathed knife and a number of grenades. He held his helm in one hand. His other rested atop his bolt gun. Apis's features were covered in an intricate latticework of tattoos. Amatnam recognized them as lines taken from the sermons of Corferon. Apis was a blunt, plain-spoken Colchisian, one of the last of that generation of warriors who had followed Lorgar first through the desert and then to the stars. He was loyal to the values that had carried them all so far, one of the few who had never questioned, even in his hearts, the path the Urizen had set them on. Not a fanatic, not a zealot, simply a believer. Amatnam admired that. The manifold complexities of the universe were boiled down to utmost simplicity in Apis's mind. The gods commanded, and he obeyed. Amatnam wished, on occasion, that he could share such an uncomplicated outlook. Instead, he was blessed, or cursed, with a higher understanding. Like Corferon, he saw the universe for what it was. He saw the mistakes, the cracks in the glass, and was driven to repair them.
Good, he said.
He turned to Kellum.
You have command. Keep us in one piece, if you would, brother.
If the gods will it, my lord,
Kellum said.
Gloria Aeterna, brothers.
The ship shuddered around them as they descended into its bowels. Slaves ran to and fro on matters of urgency. The thunder of the gunnery decks and the howls of monstrous overseers reverberated through the corridors. Battle servitors, crooked, insect-like machines infested with lesser demons and dark technologies, hummed arrhythmically in their alcoves, awaiting the unlikely event of a boarding action. All was as it should be. Lackenhugh was awaiting them in the launch bay.
I detest gunships,
the Dark Apostle said.
Too much can go wrong.
His blade slaves crouched behind him, glaring balefully at any unwary enough to get too close to their master.
Feel free to stay behind, brother, Amatnim said.
Around them, the bay was full of noise and confusion. Gunships of all shapes and sizes were being readied for launch by slaves and a paltry few servitors. Some of the gunships had been in the Legion's service since Kalth. Others had been scavenged from battle since, repaired and refitted, and made ready for war.
You'd like that, wouldn't you?
I would,
Apis said. Lacamhew spun, fixing the other word-bearer with a glare.
Curb your tongue, Apis. You are barely an officer, and only by virtue of your hardiness. Do not presume to converse with us as equals.
Amatnim clapped Apis on the shoulder plate.
Apis has no equal, brother. He is without peer in the art of organized murder. Tell him about Conqueror's Dew, Apis, when we were with the Iconoclastic Brotherhood.
Amatnim laughed.
Oh, how he made those great statues dance.
Lacamhew snorted impatiently.
I have heard the story.
Good stories deserve to be told more than once.
As I said, I have heard it. We should use drop pods. It is more efficient.
Were this a siege, I might. But this is a blitzkrieg, to borrow an antiquated term. A rapid strike to cut the heart from the enemy.
He looked at Apis.
We'll need to be fast. Don't let them dig in. Mortal or no, those fanatics are tenacious. If they manage to fortify that structure, we could be days burning them out, and they'll make us pay for every one.
Lacamhew laughed.
Surely you're not frightened of a few mortal warriors?
Amatnim smiled.
Have you ever fought the Battle Sisters, Lacamhew?
No.
Apis snorted, and Amatnim quieted him with a gesture.
Ah. Then, to answer your question, no, I am not frightened. I am, however, wary. They are skilled, zealous, and lacking in even the rudiments of a sense of fear.
A shame, then, that they serve a false god,
Lacamhew said.
Yes.
Amatnim turned to Apis.
Gather your cohort. I would have you with me when we land. We will strike for the library as soon as we reach the landing zone.
Apis bowed his head.
Gloria Aeterna, my lord. Gloria Aeterna, brother.
Dear, unimaginative clod,
Lacamhew said, as the other word-bearers left.
Why you favor him, I shall never understand.
No, I don't expect you will, brother. Are you certain you wish to accompany me with the first wave? That has never been your preference.
It is not my preference now, but it must be done. What is that clamoring?
Amatnim smiled.
Our slaves make ready for war.
The gunships and assault landers had begun to load their cargoes. Hundreds of mortals climbed the boarding ramps to cram themselves into every available space. Those who survived the descent would join the attack. Amatnim watched them board their landers with bemusement. The mortals were, for all intents and purposes, numberless, culled from a thousand worlds as the Glory Eternal made its fiery pilgrimage across the galaxy. They were the remains of various revolutions and rebellions, of broken regiments and faith-blind cults. Thousands of soldiers, pilgrims and lunatics, bound to Amatnim's will by their belief in the dark gods.
Chattel,
Lacamhew said, as rank upon rank of mortal warriors climbed aboard a nearby landing barge. Some sang as they went, others chanted and danced, spinning in tight circles or twitching and creeping in curious ways. Bells rang and cymbals clashed. Great staves topped by steaming censers were held aloft to sweeten the air. Interspersed in this ecstatic tide were islands of discipline, but they were few and far between.
Fellow travellers, Amatnim corrected. They worship as we do, and are blessed in their own ways. Their lives are a gift to us, brother, to be used in good cause.
He gestured to the mortals.
Look at them, brother. Do you truly think that they are less faithful than we?
They are chattering at them. Little souls scuttling in the shadow of our greatness.
All souls have their uses in the eyes of the gods, Lacamhew. Amatnim looked at him. Or do you think your worth is greater than theirs?
I am not so naive as to think the gods care for anything other than blood and souls,
Lacamhew said piously.
Our glory is to serve them up both. Let others seek favor or claim the love of the gods. I am content to be faithful, to be a bearer of the word. It is our fate to serve the Pantheon and enact their will upon the universe. We shall spread the word of Lorgar from one side of the galaxy to the other.
Yes. When do we plan on starting that particular crusade, brother? Amatnim laughed. Because it seems to me that we are no longer at the forefront of the long war, that others have supplanted us as we become veritable hermits.
Speak clearly, brother.
You know well enough of what, of whom I speak. Erebus licks the War Master's boots and hinders the efforts of his own brethren. He fixed Lacamhew with a steady eye. Deny it, if you like. I know the truth.
Corferin's truth.
As I said, I know the truth.
Sophistry!
Amatnim laughed. Perhaps you're right, but I notice you do not deny my assumption, because you know in that, at least, I am right. He tapped Lacamhew's chest, provoking a warning grunt from one of the blade slaves. Erebus's loyalties have always been suspect, and his faith is decidedly self-centered. Lacamhew brushed his hand away.
Careful, brother. My patience is finite.
And still you do not deny my statement. Perhaps because you harbor some doubt, eh? Amatnim leaned close. Tell me, brother, is it Erebus who wishes me dead? Or just you? And if it is him, why then does he fear me?
The hand of destiny fears nothing,
Lacamhew snarled.
Least of all some swollen-headed legionary who never had the courage to question the doddering pronouncements of a creature like Corferin.
As he spat his words, his blade slaves growled in support. Amatnim stepped back, hands spread.
Ah, and there is the bile our legion is infamous for. The poison that burns in all our veins. A heady venom of envy, spite, and wrath.
He was provoking the other word-bearer now, enjoying his anger.
Spite is but strength, envy merely the seed of ambition, and wrath is the reward of all who oppose us.
Lacamhew waved his blade slaves back.
These things are what drive us. Mock them, if you will, but know you mock your brothers at the same time.
Amatnim was about to reply, but paused. Though the slaves continued to work and the mortal warriors continued to board, the word-bearers who were present were watching the confrontation closely. Such duels of words were what passed for entertainment among the Legion. They were tests of will, wit, and wisdom. If he was judged to have failed, he would have to contend with more than just Lacamhew.
You are wrong. You know, he said, choosing his words carefully. I have questioned Corferin often. He, at least, holds to those traditions, unlike Erebus.
Erebus does what the gods ask of him, and only that.
And they ask him to serve Abaddon, then? To keep us weak, so that we cannot threaten the War Master's claims of ascendancy?
It was an old accusation, almost ritual at this point. Some word-bearers believed it to be gospel. Others thought it simply one allegation amid thousands of similar claims. The members of the Dark Council had spent centuries waging a war of contention with each other.
Abaddon was chosen by the gods,
Lacamhew began.
As were we, Amatnam said. Are you any less faithful than Abaddon?
Amatnam looked around.
What about you, brothers?
Lacomhue stiffened.
What do you mean?
Amatnam smiled.
When the Warmaster shattered the Cadian Gate in his futile impotence, all the devils left hell for warmer climes, us included. We all followed where he led. Now the galaxy burns once more, and we shake the stars with our march. A beautiful, glorious time to be alive, wouldn't you say so, brothers?
He paused.
Perhaps it was a reward for our faith.
He laughed, and others laughed with him, bitterly, angrily, but together. Lacomhue glanced around. Amatnam knew the Dark Apostle was making the same calculations he was, or perhaps trying to figure out a way of strategically withdrawing from the argument.
You speak dismissively of one the gods have chosen to enact their will.
An Erebus does not, when he thinks the War Master's spies aren't listening.
Amatnam shook his head.
Lacomhue, my brother, you know as well as I that though we all inevitably serve the same masters, we are not on the same side. It stings my conscience to know we are at odds.
Lacomhue laughed bitterly.
Not even you indulge in such a vice as that, brother.
Amatnam frowned.
Without conscience, man is no better than an animal. It was his conscience that drove the blessed Urizen to set himself against his father and brothers, Lacomhue. It was his conscience that brought us here, to this moment, amidst all moments. It is conscience that drives me here.
Lacomhue shook his head and looked away.
It is lucky for you, brother, that the gods favor the foolish and the mad.